Hello and welcome to Science Weekly. I'm Ian Sample. On this week's programme...
Richard Dawkins has written that he couldn't possibly write a book about sex because he's never come across a convincing explanation for why it even exists. And so I started to think, oh, there's something in this, isn't there?
Michael Brooks on the things science can't explain. We hear from the head of the UN's panel on climate change on how Obama will have a fight on his hands if he brings in deep carbon cuts. And the Bath Literature Festival discusses the purposefulness of evolution and aliens.
If we do find extraterrestrial life, it will be by far the most exciting, not from a scientific viewpoint, but from a theological viewpoint. If we don't hear anything in 50 years, give up.
Plus, we have news of the European Space Agency's new mission to map Earth's gravity, how you can blame your stupidity on your old man, a rock-throwing chimp that's challenged our ideas of consciousness, and how mind-reading might be closer than we know you think. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. With us in the studio today are The Guardian's Nell Bowes and Rowan Hooper from New Scientist magazine. Nell, Rowan, very good to see you both.
Hello.
Hello.
But today we are talking to Michael Brooks. Michael is a consultant for New Scientist who seemed to be infiltrating The Guardian stronghold today and author of the book 13 Things That Don't Make Sense. In it, he uncovers some extraordinary mysteries that scientists have been unable to explain. Why can't we see 96% of the universe? Why is self-will a myth? And why do we bother having sex? When he came into the studio, I asked him where he got the idea from for the book.
I was working at New Scientist at the time, and we were constantly reporting on things that scientists have done, things that scientists have achieved. And it just occurred to me, wouldn't it be interesting to look at the things that they haven't achieved and the things they haven't managed to work out yet? And then had to go off and find what these things were. And it had to be things that were really valid, things that were proper sort of scientific results that nobody had a good explanation for.
What really stood out as your sort of personal favourites in this?
Well, I mean, the obvious ones, in a sense, the missing universe. We don't know what 96% of the universe is, which is a statistic that just staggers me every time I say it. You sort of think somebody might have got something wrong here, surely. Is there something wrong with the maths? For me, that's such a big one. That has such big implications because... you kind of get the impression that we've got the whole history of cosmology sorted. We know how the universe works and everything. And yet 96% of it actually doesn't fit into that particular paradigm. The other one that I really like is on the placebo effect. And the more I got into it, the deeper it went. It was like I could never get to the bottom of what was actually going on. And the National Institutes of Health in the States is just, kind of saying, well, we should get to the bottom of this, really, since we've built the whole of medicine on it, and it's just the deeper you go, the more you find, that's uncertain about it.
It certainly seems like people have studied releases of endorphins in the brain and things and saying that, oh, if you give a placebo, then you get a certain, raising of certain chemicals in the brain, which might dull pain or such like. I mean, not for everything, but it sounds as if it might help you with things like pain and maybe nausea and stuff, not other conditions like cancer and so on.
But. Well, that's right. I mean, it certainly doesn't help as far as I can work out with anything like cancer. But these Danish doctors did this study where they kind of took all the sort of mentions of placebo in the medical literature, did a meta-analysis of them all, and came to the conclusion that actually there was no evidence whatsoever that the placebo effect is actually real. And the only place where there was some slight evidence, they said, was in subjective conditions. So like self-reported things like pain and irritable bowel syndrome, where people say, oh, I don't feel very well and I don't feel this and I feel that. And that was the only place where placebo seemed to actually have a sort of clinical validity. And they said even that was really slight because when you do the experiments and you've got people doing the trials, there's a tendency for them to say things like things that they think the doctor wants to hear. And I mean, in some ways, the only reason homeopathy got into the book was because there are results and meta-analyses and everything that say it does seem to have some effect above placebo. And what we've got to work out now is what kind of effects and what kind of placebo. And, for me, I can't see any way in which homeopathy can work.
A lot of the people you must be coming across in these stories are probably going to be pretty beleaguered and sort of going against the scientific consensus. Among those characters that you've come across, who stands out as your sort of... who do you find most likeable or most credible?
I think probably most likeable and most credible is a guy called Gilbert Levin, who was part of the NASA mission in 1976 to look for life on Mars. And his experiment worked perfectly, and it found life on Mars according to all the criteria that were laid out before the mission. And then another instrument that was also on the mission said there were no organic molecules, no carbon, therefore there couldn't be life on Mars, and therefore his result was completely overruled. And the kind of the way that he spent the like subsequent 30 years saying, hold on a minute, you know, I've done every possible analysis I can do and my results stand up. And then this other instrument that said that he couldn't possibly be right was then found to be faulty sort of about 10, 15 years later. And he's just such a beleaguered man. And he's just retired this year, or just the end of last year. He's just gone into retirement. And he's never been vindicated. He's been labelled a crank. People have got tired of him going on. And, you know, he was invited to the 10th anniversary party for the Viking mission. And then he wasn't invited to the 20th anniversary one because he was just seen as too much of a troublemaker. But actually, he kind of stood up for his results. And I have a lot of respect for him.
I've got to pull you onto this idea that the chapter you've got on sex about how there being better ways to reproduce, and this is something before reading I didn't have a clue about. I mean, it's just not an area that I've researched myself.
I started to read around what the biologists were saying, and they were all coming out with these statements like, you know, we can't fathom why there's so much sex in the world. And all the, you know, if you're talking about the selfish gene and just, you know, reproducing your genes down the next generation, asexual cloning is the way to go. It's so efficient. You know, you don't share your genes with somebody else. Every creature can reproduce. So, you know, you get twice the rate of reproduction effectively. And, you know, Richard Dawkins has written that he couldn't possibly write a book about sex because he's never come across a convincing explanation for why it even exists. And so I started to think, oh, there's something in this, isn't there? And some people have said, well, it's to do with gene shuffling. And then, you know, if you shuffle your genes, then, you know, when your environment changes, you've got a bit more sort of robustness and you can survive a bit better. But when people have actually done the experiments to look at this, you know, it's a nice theory, but actually there isn't evidence that that's actually the case.
A lot of the people you've interviewed must be pretty much on the fringes of science. And has that turned you now into a conspiracy theorist? Have you changed coming out the other end of this book?
I'm less of a conspiracy theorist than I used to be. You can argue that some of these people are deluded, and some of them are. Some of them were definitely sidelined. I mean, you know, deliberately sidelined because what they were doing didn't fit within, you know, the organization that they were doing. And there was a cold fusion guy who got, you know, effectively locked in a cupboard one time. And, you know, because his bosses didn't want him to be seen, you know, in their laboratory. But he was eventually transferred to work in the stockroom. And this is a guy who's, you know, published more than 100 papers on electrochemistry. You know, he was initially really skeptical about cold fusion. And then he did more experiments and more experiments in his spare time. And he started to think that there was actually something going on. And he ended up, you know, his boss saying, look, you're a liability, you know, because you've got this reputation now that you're looking into cold fusion. I can't get a grant to support your work. And I'm going to have to just, you know, transfer you to the stockroom. And he literally ended his career with that organization, lifting shelves off boxes off shelves.
So you've got 13 in this book. What would number 14 be if you had the chance?
I think number 14 actually was just too big, which is gravity. I think, you know, the source of gravity is pretty much a mystery. Nobody understands what mass is. Nobody understands whether, you know, how gravity is mediated. So, you know, the kind of real fundamentals of gravity are missing still. And we know that relativity isn't the final answer because it doesn't fit with quantum theory. So we've got to rewrite relativity in some way. So it seems to me like there's a whole kind of swathe of things about gravity that just, you know, don't make sense.
When you just come across all these people who have been coming up with ideas that have often been rejected by science, and some of them, you know, presumably rightly so. I mean, what is your feeling of how science comes across, the scientific process, which is kind of based on this idea of if something is right, then other people will be able to reproduce it?
It's a nice, really neat way of explaining what science is all about, but it doesn't fit the reality. You know, it's not really how science works. Science is, for a start, done by human beings who have mortgages to pay and thus don't want, you know, to miss their promotion. Now, if you talk about science normally, they say, oh, it's all about falsifying theories. Well, you know, not if it's your theory. So there are all kinds of sort of mitigating factors that actually make science quite messy. And historically, this has always been the case that, you know, people have come up with an idea that has eventually been proved to be correct. And so many people have shouted them down. You know, the idea that the speed of light was finite, not infinite. That had to wait until Cassini died before that was accepted, because he was so convinced that it couldn't possibly be the case. that you know, his, even though the experimental data showed that it was fine, right, he basically, you know, overruled and said, no, you know, I'm right, they're wrong. So it's not like this clean cut idea where somebody has a good idea, somebody proves it, and then it all works. You know, it's much more messy than that.
Michael Brooks. Nell Rowan, isn't all this a bit disheartening? Here we are in the 21st century and still we have these glaring mysteries in science. I mean, you know, how does the community see these things? Are they an embarrassment or are they an opportunity?
Actually, I don't think it's disheartening at all. The only thing disheartening in a way is that 13 Things That Don't Make Sense is the most popular thing of all time on New Scientist's website. Yeah. And now it's back again in book form. But I think it's quite inspiring, actually, to look at these things and think there's still so much there. And it makes you want to do science, actually, or find out more about it.
It also points up, I think, the fact that scientific process isn't this kind of flawless, gentle curve towards knowledge.
Mainstream science does seem to be very good at ignoring these kind of outlier maverick views, and to some extent it has to. But do you think, you know, every revolution has come by because of a maverick who's been right? And do you think science just gets too conservative? I mean, where do you draw that line? How do you do the judgment?
But because if you don't have any, you don't have any objective standards by which to measure how valid facts are, that you've got to have some kind of gentle consensus in order to get from day to day. Mm. I mean, you just have to be able to do stuff day to day, and you have to be able to make a decision on whether to publish a paper day to day. And you can only do that on a sort of general feeling of what, of the most sensible interpretation. I don't know, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that the kind of romantic idea of the maverick might get overplayed a bit, because most mavericks are nutters, basically, and we should ignore them, right? But then there are ones that have really interesting ideas, and the one I thought about during this bit is James Lovelock, who also worked on the Mars program with NASA, and he had some great ideas about life on Mars that were totally ignored by NASA. And then his Gaia ideas now, of course, are coming right back into fashion. He was, he still is a maverick, but it's kind of being vindicated in some ways. So
the interesting thing about this book is what it asks people about how they view science, about non-scientists, how they view science. I don't know, I was reading Ben Goldacre's book the other day, and that kind of, that sort of, that general idea that science is, oh my God, it's flawed, and oh no, it's just a bunch of authority figures telling us stuff, and these are all theories that we don't, you know, we don't know, they could change. And I wonder if kind of 13 Things is playing up to that a bit. I don't know, that may be unfair.
You can decide for yourself. 13 Things That Don't Make Sense is out now, and you can get it at the Guardian Bookshop, guardian.co.uk/bookshop. Now here's some of our other stories from Science This Week with Nell and Roan in the News Jam.
News Jam.
Scientists have used brain scans to read people's memories and work out where they were as they wandered around the virtual building. The landmark study by British researchers demonstrates that powerful imaging technology is increasingly able to extract our innermost thoughts. In the study, volunteers donned a virtual reality headset and were asked to make their way between four locations in a virtual environment. Throughout the task, their brain activity was monitored using a technique called functional magnetic resonance imaging. Eleanor Maguire's team found that they could accurately predict where people were standing from the brain images alone.
The loutish behaviour of a stone-throwing chimpanzee at a zoo near the Arctic Circle has challenged scientists' beliefs about human beings. Santino, a 31-year-old male at Furuvik Zoo in Sweden, may be the first non-human primate to exhibit an unambiguous ability to plan for the future, a behaviour many scientists argue is unique to humans. Zookeepers observed Santino calmly collecting stones and making concrete discs in his enclosure, which he arranged into piles facing the visitors. When the crowds arrived, Santino began hurling the missiles at people, returning to the piles to resupply. Forward planning takes considerable cognitive skills, because it requires an animal to envisage future events it will have to deal with.
Children born to older men perform worse in intelligence tests than those with younger fathers, researchers have found. A review of medical records of more than 30,000 children showed that those born to 20-year-old men scored on average 3 points higher in IQ tests than children whose fathers were 50 years old when they were born. The finding is the first to link men's age to impaired cognitive ability in their offspring, and builds on recent work that suggests older men are more likely to have children with congenital heart defects, autism, schizophrenia, and childhood cancers.
The European Space Agency is to launch its latest satellite, GOCHE, which will map tiny variations in the Earth's gravitational field. Information from the probe will tell us about changes in the ocean currents and explore conditions over hazardous volcanic regions. The satellite is one of Europe's most ambitious missions to date.
Let's pick up on a couple of those. Rowan, this story about children being born to older men score worse on IQ tests. I mean, that's it's a small effect, but it's still an effect. I mean, is this is it significant in terms of, you know, children's development, or is this just one of those sort of queries for scientists? You know, here's something we should look at.
Well, I think we should look at it because it was a big study, more than 30,000 kids in the study. Very small IQ difference, as you say. But it's kind of interesting because it's the opposite way than it is with women. So when women get older and have children, they it gives them the children a higher IQ boost. And you might expect that older men might give their children a greater boost in life with more opportunities, and that might lead to a boost in IQ. Mm. But actually, you see a small effect the other way. So that's kind of interesting.
Now, what do you reckon of this?
Well, I have to say I haven't read the study, and I don't know. Is there anything else that's kind of related to how old you are when you have your children that is affecting the IQ? Did they look into that? I mean, kind of, why are you having children that late? What's your social status and other kind of confounding factors?
I think they controlled for that. Well, they're suggesting there might be something to do with older sperm, with maybe mutations building up in older sperm, which are somehow causing this very small effect on IQ.
Okay. So it's not to do with kind of whether they're more able to jump around and play with the kids and stimulate them at a young age, or kind of, they have looked at the kind of the structure behind, or theories behind why they might see this effect.
Well, they've speculated.
I think that's a really interesting point, though, because I think What their hunch is, after looking at some of the medical conditions that come up in children who are born when their dads are much older, you do see quite a variety of sort of slight increases, but in a real variety of things. So you do have more autism, more some sort of subtle sort of schizophrenia type things and mental health effects, but also childhood cancers, cleft palate and things like that, which you could imagine, you know, would have could have some sort of genetic or epigenetic component. And I think they're saying, ergo, maybe some of this effect we're seeing in IQ might be something to do with an impaired neural development in the children. And they only looked at their IQ up to sort of 7 years old. So we don't know if these kids then make it up. I mean, it's a small difference that you're seeing. But it is an odd one, sort of looking at the environment that these kids are going to be in. I mean, are these men who've had children much later in life because actually they didn't really want children and they just ended up having them? And actually, they're not particularly interested. Anyway, moving on from that, let's get to Santino, this chimp in Sweden. And the media made a lot of this. Rowan, do you think it's been overdone a little bit? I mean, is this not really overturning what it means to be a human being and what it means to be a primate, a non-human primate?
Yeah, it's the latest in the unique traits that are humans to fall. It might be a little bit overdone, but I think if I was a chimp in a zoo, I'd throw rocks at visitors just to pass the time as well, or to let them know how I felt being in a cage. The researchers also said that Japanese macaques make caches of rocks and don't generally throw them, but sometimes they do. And that reminded me one time I was swimming to an island in Japan and some macaques chucked rocks at me and my friends to stop us trying to get onto the island. So I've seen this behaviour before in monkeys even. Yeah, and there's lots of examples of tool making, which you can argue is planning for the future. We've even seen fossilized remains of fossil evidence that chimps made Stone Age tools. Then there's spears. There's weaponized chimps using spears to hunt bush babies with.
I was going to say, even picking up a stick and stripping off the leaves in order to fish for termites or whatever is to some extent thinking ahead, isn't it?
Yeah, to some extent, but
greater time period,
right,
is that the thing, or
right,
is it?
Yeah, well, the idea was that he was collecting these, making these piles hours before the gates opened, and so in anticipation of the gates opening. And what was nice was he was on an island with a moat around it, and about a quarter of it was exposed to the kind of viewing platform that the visitors come in on, and the piles were only in the quarter facing the facing the guests. Rowan, what else have New Scientist been up to lately?
Well, going back to the chimp Santino thing, we had this quite cool story about chimps in the forest in Ivory Coast. When they're traveling through the jungle, they seem to use geometry to get between places. So they don't just use landmarks, local landmarks, to guide them, but they seem to have some internal Euclidean map that they use to navigate. So they kind of go along the hypotenuse of a triangle.
They can do shortcuts.
I bet they're rubbish at pool, though. The latest science stories are available all day, every week on our site, guardian.co.uk/science. Now, unless you spent last week living in an underground bunker, you can't have failed to notice there was a climate change conference going on in Copenhagen. It was convened to discuss new findings in climate science that have come to light since the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change published its last report in 2007. At the meeting, the head of the IPCC, Rajendra Pachauri, admitted that President Barack Obama will face a revolution if he commits the US to deep carbon cuts that scientists and campaigners say are needed.
President Obama, right from the time he was campaigning, and even after he's taken office, has clearly said that, firstly, that the economic crisis is no excuse for not taking action on climate change. And secondly, that in order to bring about recovery of the economy, you need to create green jobs. Then you're killing two birds with one stone. You're developing a new sector of economic activity and employment, which is sustainable, which will stay for all time to come. The US has to at least get to the level of the EU. And I can tell you, some of them appreciate that fact. Now, whether it happens, I don't know. But just bringing it down to 1990 levels by 2020 is not enough. But look at it from the political point of view. You've got to give him a little bit of space. He's not going to say that by 2020 I'm going to reduce emissions by 30%. He'll have a revolution on his hands. And, you know, he has to do it step by step. Look at the people that he's got in office. He's got Steve Chu as Secretary of Energy. He's got Carol Browner, and, you know, I saw her as well. And she made a very good point. She says, in 5 weeks of taking office, this administration has done more than anyone would do in 5 years.
But how, how long can we give them, then? Are you saying that you
don't think the US won't
commit to 20-30% cuts this year?
No, I'm only going by the statement that Obama has made. But I think there'll be a tightening of the situation.
But if we leave here in December,
yeah,
and the US has not taken on the kind of commitments that Europe has suggested, is that a failure?
It's hard to say. I mean, really depends on what they come up with.
But in terms of science, in terms of response to the science, do you think it's an adequate response?
Well, if I could express an opinion, which is very difficult to justify purely on the basis of science, I personally think that the 2-degree target also needs to be questioned. I mean, one of the things that we have brought out very clearly in the fourth assessment report is that with that level of stabilization, we are going to essentially commit the world to sea level rise on account of warming of the oceans themselves.
We're just going back to the US, though. If the US were not to take on the kind of commitment that Europe has suggested, is that a fair response to the science? Or is it, do they need to do a lot more than that?
Coming from where the US is currently, that represents a major step forward. It may not be the last word. I think if they come close to where the EU position is, that clearly shows they are emphasizing the science. And therefore, I don't think that's going to be lost on them.
That was The Guardian's David Adam talking to Rajendra Pachauri. Rome, we're in the middle of the worst financial crisis anyone can remember, and the US hasn't historically taken much of a lead in climate change. I mean, is there any reason to be optimistic?
Well, I think we've got to be optimistic, really. We've got people like Pachauri, Nicholas Stern, saying this recession is an opportunity to look at the economy and start building a green economy and to invest in renewable energy. They're saying it's actually an opportunity. So I think you've got to be optimistic in that sense.
But I suppose some people would say they would say that, wouldn't they? I mean, do you believe that?
I don't know. I mean, Lovelock seems to have given up on it. He's saying it's time just to protect ourselves from inevitable climate change now. Pachauri and Nicola Stern aren't going that far yet. They're still saying, look, we there's still time. So I'm kind of in between the two, actually. I don't know.
And we've got until later in the year, I suppose, we'll find out with the next Copenhagen meeting.
Yeah, I mean, the next one is the politics. This one was the science. But I think this one did start to expose the tension between the science and the politics. So how far do the scientists start saying that the previous IPCC predictions were wrong? How much doom and gloom should they start shouting about? Or should they leave that to the politicians? Or do the politicians need a push in that direction?
The Guardian's resident Welshman, James Randerson, has been roaming Britain's West Country, and recently he ended up at the Bath Literature Festival. While he was there, he came across the Cambridge paleontologist Simon Conway Morris and Elaine Morgan, advocate of the curious aquatic ape hypothesis. At the end of their session, they took questions from the floor, and in a moment you'll hear their take on the purposefulness of evolution and the futility of arguments on the creation debate. But first they responded to a comment asking how the lack of evidence for aliens was missing from the story of evolution.
As most of you will know, there's this famous Fermi paradox, which does suggest that there's no evidence of visitation in a fossil record, which is not as daft as it sounds. We have no evidence of signals at all. We have no evidence of stellar systems being manipulated in a technological way. We may just be listening on the wrong wavelengths. I have a colleague who is being very much involved in this area called Frank Drake, who devised the famous Drake equation. He says, on present extrapolations of the search methods we're using, if we don't hear anything in 50 years, give up. But if we do, as again I've pointed out with other people, if we do find extraterrestrial life, it will be by far the most exciting, not from a scientific viewpoint, but from a theological viewpoint, because again, it will be another version of the Copernican revolution, which I think is an absolute set of clichés.
I think the aliens are more improbable than he does. I think a series of accidents helped to us. I think if we had not originally been arboreal, we would not have had the right kind of things to stand upside. If we had not then gone into the sea, we wouldn't have had the ability to learn to speak. And all those things would have to be repeated on some distant planet to produce us again.
With regard to the selfish gene, by importing the word selfish, you're importing a human value. I think the fatal problem of the selfish gene is that actually there's no such thing as a gene. There's genetic information, of course.
What puts people off, Richard Dawkins and people who talk about the selfish gene, is that they have got this idea that all the things built into us, basic, are selfish and nasty and personal and greedy. There used to be a way of putting this. You'll have to forgive the language. I'm not being vulgar, but I need this word to prove my point. They said in the laboratories that there are only four Fs at the bottom of the human psyche: feeding, fleeing, fighting, and fucking. And if you've got those four, then you can account for the whole of human behavior. And what I say is this: that if you had a generation with only those four, it would not last more than one generation. It would not leave any descendants. Why not? Because this male, however many fights he won and however many females he impregnated, would leave no descendants because the females would give birth to a baby and walk off and leave it there, and it would die. So that unless in the human being there was a fifth F, which is fostering and friendship and other kinds of things, but particularly that first fostering, we have got deeply in our psyche the need to care and put ourselves second to the needs of some other thing.
Elaine, this point about purposefulness and evolution, I mean, in your... In your book, there's a quote saying, arguing with creationists is a waste of time.
I can see a lot in favour of it, but I can't prove it one way or the other. I feel that way about God. I mean, he might be there, he might not be there. We can't prove it one way or the other. I do feel that it would be helpful to keep the two things apart, religion on one side and science on the other, because the way it is now, they're sort of boiling up and spitting hate at each other, which seems quite unnecessary, because after Darwin died, they settled down and they said, yes, the Church of England can accept him, the Catholics can accept Darwin. And they had sort of theology building and a science building next to each other, no trouble at all. Now suddenly they're all spitting hate. And I think it's coming partly from America. Some of my best friends are Christians. I wouldn't dream of trying to argue them out of it, and they don't try to argue me out of it. I differ from Richard Dawkins because he thinks it is bad and dangerous. Look at what happens. Well, I mean, they've used that argument against Darwin. Look what happens at Darwin. It led to sterilization and eugenics and Hitler and all that. Mm. But on the other hand, we could say, well, look what believing in God led to. You had these Protestants and Catholics burning each other at the stake in the name of the Prince of Peace. And there is nothing to be gained by arguing with each other because it's not a scientifically provable thing.
That was potty mouth Elaine Morgan and Simon Conway Morris at the Bath Literature Festival. Now, Rowan, this 50 years to find E.T., according to Simon Conway Morris, and no trace of him in the fossil record. We better get cracking.
I think working out whether they're there or not and working out how one would recognise them is kind of important before you go, oh, they're not there. Right, let's conclude that we should have been contacted by now.
On our blog, we've had comments this week from Base Island and Ringster, who were sceptical of the example of Jonah Lehrer's instinctive thinking talked about on the last programme. Lehrer talked about the case of Michael Riley, who was in the radar room of HMS Gloucester during the Gulf War and on the lookout for enemy missiles. He was gripped by fear when he had to fire at an unknown target, which was the enemy, eventually saving the day for the Allied forces. Base Ireland asked,
was there any more detailed testing of the hypothesis?
Elsewhere, Hovlad enjoyed our discussion on the terminology of branding those opposed to the theory of anthropogenic climate change. Do we call them climate change sceptics, denialists or creationists? He agrees sceptic is wrong and denialist has already been taken.
However, I believe that the far-ranging acceptance still of some form of creationism with society means that such branding could be seen as a swipe just as much as the term denialist and could galvanise the religious to the cause of these people. Moreover, it could just give the expelled crown even more armament. I appreciate that this is a slippery slope argument, but we could end up with people who hold religious beliefs finding themselves drawn to the climate change crowd through necessity.
He suggests dismissers or renegers. Any more suggestions out there? We have a video at guardian.co.uk/environment of our US environment correspondent Suzanne Goldenberg, who meets some climate change dismissers, cranks, ostriches, or whatever else you want to call them. That's it for this week's programme. Drop your comments off at our blog and don't forget our new Twitter feeds for science news and this podcast. You can find it all at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Thanks to Lel and Rowan for coming in today. We'll be back next week with Demis Hassabis. He's a computer game designer, AI programmer, neuroscientist and world-class games player. There's nothing he can't do. Until next week, I'm Ian Sample. The programme was produced by Scott Corley. Thanks for listening.